Perception is reality until proven otherwise. Reality is objective. Perception is subjective. Reality describes things as they actually are. Perception is about how we perceive things to be or how we interpret things to be. And often, at least sometimes, our perceptions may be faulty. And when our perceptions are faulty, they create a false reality because our perception becomes a reality until it is proven otherwise. And the problem with that is that faulty perceptions, we have those because we are not aware that they're faulty. We don't understand. We don't know. It isn't intentional. We're unaware. We don't recognize that our perceptions are mistaken. Example, when they brought the bloodied coat of Joseph, that multicolored coat that his brothers had stained with animal's blood, and brought it to him and said, "This is Joseph's coat. An animal has killed him, and Joseph is dead." How did Jacob respond? With shock, no doubt. Surreal, this can't be happening, because that's usually what happens first when people die. Grief, yes. Mourning, yes. Probably tears, weeping. And he mourned and grieved the loss of his son for many, many years. And you might ask, well, why are you crying? Joseph isn't really dead. Was Joseph dead? He wasn't. The reality is Joseph is alive. That's reality. Perception is Joseph is dead. So how did he respond in that case? He responded in exactly the same way he would have responded had Joseph actually been dead. There was no difference because his perception was his reality until it was proven otherwise many, many, many years ago. And I want to kind of help you understand that as we take a look at this whole concept, the difference between perception and reality, from a passage in the 33rd chapter of Jeremiah. And in particular, I call this message Beyond the Wall. And you'll understand the title in just a moment. When we get to Jeremiah, you need to understand historically that Jeremiah was among the last prophets that were sent to the judgment-bound southern kingdom of Judah. For nearly 40 years, he had prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem and the captivity of Judah at the hands of the Babylonians. Jeremiah 33 is written near the end of Jerusalem's fall. Okay, near the end. It's about to wrap up. Jerusalem did not fall to the Babylonians all at once in one great massive attack. The Babylonians besieged Jerusalem for a number of years, and the attacks came in waves and different phases, and that's how the collapse occurred. When you get to the 33rd chapter of Jeremiah, written around 587 BC, it was during the second year of the final siege. This is the final siege of Jerusalem. And as you read in Jeremiah 33, it is apparent from the writing that the end is very near. Notice what he says. Now, listen carefully, though you have torn down the houses of this city and even the king's palace to get materials to strengthen the walls against the siege weapons of the enemy, the Babylonians will still enter the city. Now, from this we can recognize they have walls, but they're being breached and the Babylonian soldiers are coming through. So what are they doing to try to shore up the walls, to reinforce the walls, to keep them from penetrating into the city? They have actually gone, you can see here, they are tearing down the boards and the materials from their own houses because there isn't anything left to do. There is no other material available. And even the materials, the stones, the wood from the king's palace, and they're using that to build up the walls against the siege weapons of the enemy. And he said, though you are doing this, the Babylonians will still enter the city. In other words, your efforts to prevent this, your efforts to stop this from happening will be futile. You're doing your very best. You're doing all you know to do. And you are expending all of your resources to prevent this from happening because you don't want this to happen. But in spite of that, there's nothing you can do that's going to prevent this from taking place. Your best effort will fail even as you expend and deplete all of your resources to prevent it. Then he goes on to say, the men of this city are already as good as dead. Today might say dead men walking, for I have determined to destroy them in my terrible anger. I have abandoned them because of all their wickedness. And I'll talk about this a little bit later as God's purpose and activity in judgment. And what you read here and what you see here is that these verses demonstrate that the efforts of the king and the people to save Jerusalem, to protect what they have, to protect where they are, to protect this place. You see, because they're going to be disposed. They're going to be captured and taken away into Babylon, which was between the Euphrates River, be hundreds of miles away. They're going to be displaced from their homeland. Okay? And you're trying very hard to prevent this from happening. But there isn't anything you can do to stop this. Because the houses, here's what, understand, the houses and the royal palaces of Jerusalem were not destroyed by the Babylonians, but by the citizens of Judah who tore up the buildings to get materials to fortify their defenses against the Babylonians. No matter, he says, your efforts to defend the city will be useless. And in verse 5, when he talks about the dead bodies, that's in verse 5, he is referring to the defenders of Jerusalem. With no help from heaven and facing the wrath of God who is determined to destroy them, he says they are as good as dead. Now that's not a very good word, at least according to our perception. Our perception says this is absolute, total despair, hopelessness, futility. There is nothing good after this. This is surely the end of Judah, surely the end of Jerusalem, surely the end of the nation of Israel. It is not a good word. I can hardly think of anything that would be worse. Jerusalem is falling. The city is being destroyed. The city's defenders are like dead men walking, and the survivors, those who survive, are facing 70 years of captivity in a foreign land. That's what they see in front of them. That's the wall that they're facing. But back up in Jeremiah 33 to verse 2 and 3. And here's what we read before we get to that. Thus saith the Lord who made the earth, the Lord who formed it to establish it. Notice the word Lord is in all capital letters. And in English, that means the Hebrew word is Jehovah. Thus says Jehovah who made the earth, the Jehovah who formed it to establish it. Jehovah is his name. Here's what he says. Call to me, and I will answer you, and I will tell you great and mighty things which you do not know. One translation says, I will tell you great and unsearchable things that you do not know. Unsearchable, you couldn't possibly imagine. Things that you cannot conceive of, that in your wildest imagination and wildest dreams you would never ever think could be possible. I will give you great and unsearchable things. And this promise is being given to them in the context of certain and decisive judgment. And what's very interesting here is the word unsearchable is from the Hebrew word basur. And in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 28, that same word is used to describe the fortified cities of Canaan, and it literally means walled up. At that point in time, that is an apt description. It is an appropriate image. Because very much they are up against, we have that expression in English, my back's against the wall. They were up against the wall. And think about what it means. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Your homeland is going to be occupied. Many of you are going to be killed. The Babylonians are going to take you captive. They're going to hold you there for 70 years. It looks like everything that's familiar to you, everything that's precious to you, everything that your life has centered around for all of these years, you are about to be uprooted and rudely and forcefully moved to a new place under the influence of a foreign power, of a foreign king. That's the wall. But in the context of that, he says to them, call to me and I will answer you. And I will let you look beyond the wall. I know your perception is that this is the end. You've done everything you could to keep this from happening, but it's happened. All your resources weren't enough. Everything you had to bring to this situation was inadequate and failed. And now you're hopeless and helpless and without strength, and everything seems pointless and futile. And where do I go from here? It's over for me. And yet God is saying, if you call to me, I will show you great. I will let you look beyond the wall from what you perceive to what is actually, what is the reality that I have for you beyond this wall. Are you getting this morning? Are you getting it this morning? Your perception is this, but let me show you the reality of what is waiting for you on the other side of the wall. And it is an appropriate description. They're trying to protect themselves from foreign invaders. They are hiding behind walls that have been besieged, walls that have been fortified with the destroyed remains of their houses. I mean, think about that a minute. They're all of their personal private possessions, their house, you know, your castle, the place where you live, the place you call home. It is now being expended to keep this from happening. And when they look at the wall around them and in front of them, all they see is death, defeat, and despair. Their world is falling apart, and everything they know and love is collapsing and falling in shambles at their feet within breached, broken walls of destruction. And in the midst of this, God says, call to me, and I will show you unsearchable things. I will let you look beyond the wall to show you great things that you cannot imagine. I will let you look beyond your immediate circumstances, and I will help you to understand, listen to this, that the immediate is not the ultimate. That where you are is no indication of where I am taking you. Things so marvelous, they're too incredible for you to believe in your present circumstances. Things that you possibly cannot imagine, comprehend, much less receive or believe, while the Babylonians are invading your land and destroying your city. You don't have to ask what God is. We don't have to guess what God is talking about here. Let's keep reading. Look down to verse 6. Here's what he says. You want to see what's beyond this wall? All you can see right now is Babylonian soldiers coming through the walls that you can't fortify. Here's what I see beyond the wall. God says, nevertheless, the time will come. I know all this is happening now, but the time will come when I will heal Jerusalem's damage and give her prosperity and peace. I'll restore the fortresses of Judah and Israel and rebuild their cities. I will cleanse away their sin against me, and I will forgive all their sins of rebellion. Then this city will bring me joy. At that point in time, they cannot imagine that there would ever again be the sound of joy or rejoicing in that city. It could never be again. It's over. But they will bring me joy and glory and honor before the all nations of the earth. The people of the world will see the good I do for my people and will tremble with awe. It will become a witness and a light to the nations that are around you. This land has been ravaged, and the people and animals have all disappeared. Yet in the empty streets of Jerusalem and Judah's other town, there will again be heard once more the sounds of joy and laughter beyond the wall. I improvised a little. The joyful voices of bridegrooms and brides will be heard again, along with the joyful songs, joyous songs of people bringing thanksgiving offerings to the Lord. I don't know how much worship was going on while the Babylonians were tearing up their land. I don't know if anybody was giving any thanksgiving offerings. Probably more or less questioning and wondering and asking a lot of those questions, that why question, maybe accusing God. But he said that will change. And here's what they will sing. They will sing, give thanks to the Lord Almighty, for the Lord is good. His faithful love endures forever. For I will restore the prosperity of this land to what it was in the past, says the Lord. That is an incredible prophetic promise. And you ask, do you think when they heard this, could they have conceived that there was any possible way that this could ever happen? Because see, they already know that it's beyond their ability to make it happen, because they have already expended their best. They've done everything they know to do. They have depleted all of their resources. They stand there empty-handed, stripped, broken, and that didn't work. And now, how can this possibly be? Who would dare to make such a promise like this? If you go back and look at the verse, go back and notice verse 2, he tells them who is making this promise. He wants them to understand that this isn't some empty word from some Yahoo who just came along and prophesied something. Look at verse 2. He said, is the Lord the maker of heaven and earth, the one who created all things? The creator, the omniscient, omnipresent, almighty God. He wants them to understand. He is underscoring the veracity of this promise by affixing his eternal name to it. And he himself is the surety for the promise he is making, because a promise is never any better than the person who makes it. If a liar promises you something, you would be a fool to count on it. And the writer in Hebrews talks about, when it came to the issue of salvation, how that to make the recipients of the covenant, so that they would rest and understand and know, so that they would have assurance of the faithfulness of the one who promised. He said that God swore with an oath. He promised it by two things. He swore with an oath. And you understand the two things of this. Number one, God doesn't need to confirm anything with an oath. This whole thing, you know, of not swearing, let your yes be yes and your no be no. What's that about? It means there's just one level of truth-telling. Some people, you know, I'll swear. Now I'll tell the truth. Before I swore, I had the liberty to lie, the license to lie. You ever been talking to someone and they say, well, to tell you the truth, and I'm thinking, oh, you've been lying up till now? There's not two levels of truth. Your yes is yes and your no is no. So if God promised it, that's enough. That's the first thing. Two immutable promises. God promised it. That then to make sure to the sons of and daughters of the promise, so that they would rest in absolute confident assurance, he went beyond that and he confirmed his worth with an oath. He promised it, and then he promised to keep his promise. And he said, this is for those who have fled for refuge, which is a reference to the cities of refuge in the Old Testament. The place of safety, the place of refuge and hiding. There is a place of refuge in the promise of God. This promise would be outrageous for anyone other than God to have made it, because no human being could have possibly fulfilled it. But God said, the one who promises it, this isn't a man, this isn't an earthly king, this is the Jehovah, the maker of heaven and earth. Jehovah is his name. And my name is attached to this. And what you have here is this picture of incredible grace and mercy, of God's unfailing love for Israel, and is faithful to keep his covenant with them. If you look down in chapter 20 and 33 again at verse 20, he says, if you can break my covenant with the day and the night so that they do not come on their usual schedule, only then will my covenant be broken. And it's a kind of a rhetorical question. If you can break the covenant where the sun no longer rises in the morning and sets in the night, that's when I'll break my covenant. Well, when can we do that? Never. That covenant cannot be broken by us. And there is not only that. Listen, God not only promises, he gives them a sign. And God often does that, because he knows how to reinforce our fragile faith. He knows our tendency to doubt in the dark what we heard in the light. And the longer the time lapse between the giving of a promise and its fulfillment, the greater our tendency to question or wonder or even deny the reality of that promise. So that's why when God promised Noah, I will never again destroy the earth with a flood, he gave him a sign. He put a rainbow in the cloud as a sign of that covenant. So God is now making an incredible promise. And you find this all through the Bible, the New Testament. The broken bread at the communion table, the cup, is a sign of his covenant with us. This is the cup, the covenant I'm making with you. He gives them a sign. And it's an incredible sign at that. And this is back in Jeremiah 32. Don't put it on the screen. God tells Jeremiah to do something quite unusual. He instructs him to go buy a parcel of land, to buy a field from his cousin, Hanamel. Now I ask you, does that make any sense at all? Is that logical? Is that sound investment at this point in time? A good investment to buy land that is about to be confiscated by foreign investors? You're going to buy it, pay for it, and the next day the Babylonians will own it. Does that make any sense at all? It doesn't. Unless God told you to do it. The fact is, the land that Jeremiah bought from his cousin had already been captured by the Babylonians. That seems absolutely preposterous with the enemy at the gates of Jerusalem, and exile is now certain. But Jeremiah obeys. He carried out the transaction with legal precision. The Bible said he paid 17 shekels of land for the silver. He got it in duplicate, two copies of the deed. were made, and they were notarized and signed by witnesses. Conditions of the sale were carefully specified, and one copy was put in a safety deposit box. Now, in ancient days, that was an earthen jar sealed. And that may sound pretty fragile to you, but they seal it with pitch, like tar. I'd remind you that the Dead Sea Scrolls survived in earthenware jars for 2,000 years like that. And he said, put it up. You see, because this is a promise that will be years. In fact, it will be 7 decades before this promise is fulfilled. But the fact that it's in that jar, and the fact that the jar is, we don't know where the jar was put. Doesn't matter where it is. God hasn't lost sight of this. God knows where the deed is. God knows where the contract is. Even if you bury it in the ground, God hasn't forgotten about this. And 50 years in Babylon, when you begin to wonder, will God ever fulfill His promise? The deed is still there and God's eyes are on it and He will not forget His promise. Maybe buried out of sight. And the purchase of this land symbolized the restoration of Israel to her land after the captivity. The Babylonians are having their way now, but this belongs to you. And they'll have it for a while, but I'm going to give it to you. And he said in verse 15, houses and fields and vineyards will again be bought in the land. And he makes that pronouncement even as the Babylonians are razing the city while their houses are being ripped apart from makeshift fences. I want you to see beyond the wall. To look past the immediate circumstances and let me show you my promises so incredible you cannot possibly imagine them. Because God has not forsaken Israel utterly. He has not abandoned. Now this is obviously a time of judgment because He said He would destroy them in His anger. And it is an act of judgment. But sometimes we fail to understand the heart of God when He acts in judgment. We think of judgment only in terms of it being punitive, or that is to punish. When in fact, very often, God acts in judgment not as a punitive measure, but for the purpose of redemption, to redeem. There is a redemptive purpose behind the judgments of God. Malcolm Smith, noted Bible teacher, said this. He said, the judgment of God is a divine tourniquet applied by a loving God to a hemorrhaging world so that it does not bleed to death. So that it does not bleed to death. The tourniquet hurts, but without it, you would bleed to death. Let me give you an example of this that you can relate to. Because you see, the path they were on would have led them to certain and total destruction. God is actually stepping in with extreme measures to save them from themselves. Because if the path they're on is allowed to continue, it will mean the utter destruction and end of this nation. And in this instance, divine intervention came about to save them from themselves. It's what someone has called severe mercy. Severe mercy. You may know about, may have read about the Black Death, the Black Plague that swept over the city of London in the year 1665. The disease was carried by fleas that lived as parasites on rats. And the city was infested with them and overrun by them. And it was contagious, highly contagious, and it was spreading everywhere. And they could not stop the spread of this disease. According to some estimates, the disease killed 40,000 dogs and 200,000 cats and more than 1,000 people per week. And by August of 1966, they said as many as 6,000 people a week were dying from the Black Plague. And this plague threatened to completely destroy the population of London. But on the night of September the 2nd in 1966, in a baker's shop on Pudding Lane, a careless maid knocked over a candle and a fire broke out. And the blaze soon became an inferno, and fanned by the east wind, it quickly spread across the city of London. The fire raged for 4 days and destroyed 80% of the city of London, and more than 13,000 homes were reduced to ashes. The city was nearly destroyed by the fire. But the fire that destroyed London burned and killed all of the rats and killed out all of the disease. And the people were saved because the fire, of like a judgment fire, if you will, a fire that burned the city, burned out the infection that was destroying them. So it isn't just a ticked off, angry God who is punishing. And there is certainly an element to that because they have sinned greatly. But His purpose is far more than that. It is redemptive. And I think that's why Habakkuk prayed in Habakkuk 3, and he said, Lord, in wrath, remember mercy. Lord, in your wrath, remember mercy. And I fully expect, folks, I fully expect that in my lifetime, we could very well see right here in our homeland an intervention of God in judgment, because as a nation right now, the path that we're on is not good. And I think everybody here knows that. And we seem powerless to turn it around. The Democrats, the Republicans, the people in Washington, they cannot fix it. Leonard Ravenhill said, revival is when God gets sick and tired of being misrepresented and decides to show himself. And right now, we need that kind of fire. Yes, it may destroy a lot of other things, but it would burn out the infectious disease that is killing us as a nation and as a people. So it wasn't just punitive. There was a redemptive mission here that God had for his people. And having understood that, you see this concept here. It's very powerful from this Old Testament prophet of Jeremiah. The difference between perception and reality. The people that are watching this happen cannot believe that there is any reality other than the one that is so graphically consuming their lives. The perception is everything they've loved, everything they've longed for, everything they've worked for, their homeland, their familiar, all that's familiar and predictable to them, all that they have cherished, is being destroyed, is being taken away, and there's nothing they can do to prevent it. They're powerless to stop this. They're being overrun, and now all of their resources are depleted. And in the midst of this, God comes. It's absolutely incredible when you think about it. I try to grasp it and get the magnitude of it. And in the midst of all of this doom and despair and gloom and destruction and the utter devastation that surrounds them, the eternal God, the creator, the maker of heaven and earth, and stands and gives us an incredible promise and says, beyond the wall, there will come a day when houses will be built here again and vineyards will be planted here again. And the land that you love, you will be replanted there. And there will be the sound of joy and bridegrooms and brides and singing and joyful sound as they song. And it will be a witness and a worship to all of the world of the faithfulness of my God. Call to me, and I will show you great and unsearchable things. I will let you look beyond the wall to see the reality that you cannot perceive at this point in time. Let me close by showing you this principle in some other places. It looked like Elisha and his servant were doomed, hopelessly outnumbered by an army of chariots that had completely surrounded them. Their perception is, we're outnumbered, we're surrounded by thousands of soldiers and horses. But if you look beyond the wall, you would see it took God to open the eyes of a servant to see it. May God open our eyes today to see it. You would see that the Syrian army that could be seen was surrounded by an angel army that could not be seen. Hallelujah. To Jacob, it looked like everything was lost. Joseph was dead. Reality? No, perception, but his perception was his reality. Joseph was dead, and now Simeon is being held in prison in Egypt, and they've come now and said, we have to take Benjamin away. And in despair, he said, all things are against me. It looked like the worst moment of his life, of a man who's been grieving the loss of Joseph and the trouble and problems in his own household. And now in his old age, it looks like, yeah, after all of this, now I have to deal with this too. That's what it looks like. That's the perception. That's what he sees when he looks at the wall. But beyond the wall, you'll see that Joseph is alive, that Simeon will be released, that Benjamin will be unharmed, that Jacob will be reunited with his family in the abundance of Egypt and the blessing of God. And not only would he see Joseph, but he would see Joseph's children and bless his grandchildren. And boy, I've learned what a joy that is. That's beyond the wall. With his eyes burned out and his head shaved, it looked like Samson was doomed to die, treading endless circles, chained to a gristmill. What a picture. A lot of people who probably feel that way, that they're just the rat race, the routine. Where's the purpose, the passion, the vision? It's buried under the walls in Israel when the Babylonians invaded. I'm just walking in circles, chained to a meaningless, menial, pointless, walking in circles. Motion but no progress. Movement without progress, without direction. Just round and round. That's what you see if you look at the wall. But if you look beyond the wall, you'll see his hair is beginning to grow again. And you'll hear him praying one last desperate prayer. And one more time, the anointing and power of God's Spirit returns to him for his greatest victory. If you wander out in the desert, you'll find a solitary prophet sitting under a juniper tree praying to die. Find a man so depressed he doesn't want to live. If you look at that, you would think that Jezebel has won, that evil has triumphed, and righteousness has lost. But if you look beyond the wall, you'll find the lonely prophet standing in a cave. And if you'll be quiet enough, you'll hear the whisper of God's voice. Not in the earthquake, the wind, and the fire, but in the whisper, in the still, small voice. And as you know, most Hebrew scholars say there was no sound at all. What kind of heart must I have to hear God when he is silent? To perceive him when I cannot hear him? And in that silence, it changed his life and returned him to greater power. No, he didn't die under a juniper tree in the wilderness. He was ushered into heaven in a whirlwind and accompanied by chariots of fire. That was what was beyond the wall. If you listen carefully, you can hear someone crying, the sound of bitter weeping coming from a disgraced disciple. Satan is sifting him like wheat, and he is consumed with guilt and shame over his failure and his denial of Jesus, a denial that was sealed with a curse. And if you stop right there, it looks like Simeon is finished. It's over. It's done. His opportunity has come and gone. The window of opportunity has passed him by. It's over. It's too late. There's no chance. But if you look beyond the wall, you'll see him beside the shore as he stands with Jesus. And Jesus quietly asks, Simon, do you love me? You'll follow him to the upper room where he waits with 120 believers. And you'll see tongues of fire sitting upon his head. And then you will hear him preach with power and boldness and see the sick healed in his shadow as Peter makes a comeback to shake the gates of hell. That was on the other side of the wall. And finally, if you stand at Golgotha on Friday and watch the bloody scene of crucifixion unfold, you'll see a Nazarene carpenter nailed to a cross. You'll watch him die in shame and disgrace, mocked by the crowd and abandoned by his father. Your perception might be that Jesus has lost, that death has prevailed, that Satan has conquered, that God's plan has failed. The reality is, if you look beyond the wall, you'll see that when Sunday has come, two women make their way to the tomb in the pre-dawn darkness, only to find the stone has been rolled away and the tomb is empty, because the one who was dead is alive and is alive forevermore, and he holds the keys to death and hell. That's beyond the wall. Call to me and I will answer you. And that's what he's asking you to do today, is just call to him.